So I thought I would do a work in progress talk about where I'm, what I'm looking at, where it comes from, and where I'm at the moment. Okay, so what I'm talking about is writing a tool where you've got a whole bunch of source code trees, and you want to find out if there's any sort of similarity between them, and in particular where the similarities are, so that you can see whether there's been some plagiarism, whether there's been some movement of code between the trees. In fact, this is an ongoing thing, something I started back in 2004, and I published a paper back then on a tool, CT Compare version 1.2. At the time, you took one tree, you took another tree, and you did a cross comparison to find out if there was any similarities. And I had an idea about 3 or 4 weeks ago whether I needed to actually have to have two trees in order to compare them. Would it be possible to take one tree and compare against an entire set of trees all at the same time? So I sort of had an idea that this was probably possible, but I wasn't exactly sure how to do it. So the old version would just compare two trees together. This version of the tool, version 2.2, takes a tree, in fact, slightly different, and actually compares it against a whole set of existing source code trees. Okay, so why do you need such a tool? Lots of different reasons. If you're an academic, then maybe you want to throw all of your students' assignments into the database, cross-compare them, to look for possible code copying between them. If you're a business person, you may have a large company that's been merged or bought or is buying another company, and you inherit a whole pile of source code for your app, for your programs. And then you get a letter in the mail from another company saying, we think that you are selling a product which is based on our product, and we would like you to stop doing that. Well, how do you know if your body of code, which could be millions of lines of stuff you've inherited from many different places, is actually using someone else's code? You need to do a code comparison. If you're putting out codes, you might have to obey a special license. If you've got code which has borrowed some GPL code, then the GPL license says whenever you modify GPL code, you've got to then re-license your new stuff according to the original license. And that means that if you use GPL code, you've then got to put your code back out under the same license. So obviously, if you want a proprietary piece of software, you don't really want to be infected by GPL. Because if you get infected by GPL, then all of your code has to be given out to everybody for free. So obviously, if you're a proprietary business, software business, you don't want to do that. And from my point of view, I'm also interested in computing history. So I'm also interested in, if I have a tree of source and I have another tree of source from 10 years later, is there anything between them that would indicate some sort of relationship? And in fact, this might even be a time sequential. So is there anything left from version 1 in the software which is now up to version 10? And if so, what are the original lines of heritage that still traverse all of those 10 years of change? Okay, so those are the reasons why. So let's move on to how. But before we get to how, we need to think about exactly what we're trying to do. We're trying to find bits of code in one tree, which is the same as a bit of code in another tree, and spot all possible occurrences of code in one tree existing in code in another tree. Okay, well, how do you do it? What are you looking for? Certainly, if you're looking for whole lines of code, then you can take a line from one file, and I've seen a tool where which takes a line of code, gets rid of the white space, calculates a hash over that line, and then runs down the other tree and looks for that same hash. But that's good. I mean, that means that if you've got, if x is less than 70 and y is bigger than 2, you can find that line between the two trees. But what happens if you do this? Now you've got two lines of code, and therefore the comparison is going to fail. So obviously doing it on a line-by-line basis isn't effective. Okay, so we really want to be able to do it so that lines can be broken up according to the rules of the language. Now, if this was Python, maybe we could do it, because Python has a particular structure that you can't break lines into multiple lines. But then at the same time, you've got the issue of how many spaces at the beginning of a line of Python, which also is something that would influence it. Can you deal with munging of code? And that's a highly technical word, munging. Munging of code. Can we deal with the fact that someone's taken an algorithm, which is unique, renamed all the variables and functions, restructured some of the lines, put it in their own code, and therefore claiming it is theirs? Now, I've seen assignments handed in where that's happened, where someone's taken someone else's code, changed all the variable names, handed the new one in, and we are supposed to determine whether that's unique or whether it's a case of plagiarism. So that's another issue we've got to deal with. What about dealing with code which can't be put out into the general public? Maybe you want to be a third party where two people are saying, yes, there's possibility of code being exchanged. How does a third party determine that? The proprietary code base can't be released to the public because that would disclose the source code. It's okay if we're talking open source versus open source, but if we're talking open source versus closed source, then that makes our detection much, much harder. How do we release something which represents the source code when it's proprietary? And the thing that I've been interested at the moment is, can we do a comparison in a way that's time efficient? Can it be done within a matter of minutes, hours? If it becomes days, weeks, then of course it's slow and pointless. And of course we have to deal with false positives. How many false positives are we going to live with? And are there any mismatches we're not going to be able to find? Okay, so those are some of the issues I came up with when I first started doing this a few years ago. So I set down a list of requirements for myself. I want to be able to detect code being rearranged. So that means moving lines around or moving sublines, breaking up lines, joining lines together. It's got to be reasonably fast. So that as the size of the trees grow, the time shouldn't take astronomically long in order to do the comparison. I was happy to live with n-squared, but nothing worse than n-squared. I want to be able to come up with a coded representation that I can export in such a way that it doesn't divulge the original code. Now there's a tension here. By giving out some representation of your code, that will allow someone to do a comparison against it. But by divulging anything, you've released something about the original structure of the source code. So the tension there, how much of the structure are you willing to release?
Sorry to interrupt, n is sort of number of lines of code?
Yeah, n is the size of the two trees that are being compared, in terms of any some sort of quant metric. So lines or things like that.
Okay, so maybe the number of nodes in the tree, it could be.
Could be like that, yeah. What I'm basically saying is, if I've got two big trees and I double both of them, is it going to get twice as fast, or twice as slow, or four times as slow, or that sort of thing? And of course, I wanted to be able to deal with the munging. I wanted to be able to deal with renamed variables, renamed constants, renamed functions, so that even if the algorithm had been maliciously changed, with still being the same algorithm, I should be able to detect it. Okay, so I realized that the line approach wasn't going to work. So I chose a different approach, and this is my stuff from a few years ago. And the idea is that I take my code and I break it up into the syntax elements that form the code. So I'm talking about the lexical tokens, the lexical elements of your source code. So every time I see the word int, it means int. Every time I see the word for, I see a for. Every time I see a left parenthesis, it's a left parenthesis. Every time I see a word that I don't recognize, X, Y, Z, then that's probably some sort of identifier. So it represents a variable or a function name or a constant, something like that. If I see something like 2, 3, 7, 8, 9, then it's a literal number. And I treat that as a token which represents a number. So there are things that are going to be single character tokens. All of the single character elements in C, I'm doing this in C, but it really is applicable to any computing language. Single character tokens. Then you've got multiple characters that actually represent a single entity. C So the assignment operator is effectively a single token because it's doing one job. It's not actually two single equals, sorry, the comparison. Thank you. It's not doing a single equals followed by a single equals. It actually is doing a single job with a double. Obviously, the language has got keywords, so each keyword becomes a separate lexical token. And then we've got things that have values. Identifiers, which I just mentioned. Things in double quotes are strings. Things in single quotes are character constants, character literals. And things that are numeric are numeric literals. And then C's still got the go-to. So we do have to deal with things that have our labels, places where we can go to. So the idea with this approach, the token approach, is that we encode every token in the tree into a single byte, because there's only 100 of them, so I can represent that easily in 8 bits. Then my original approach was to take two trees, represent it as tokens, and compare the trees together. So if this run of tokens appears in this second tree, then I've obviously found some sort of code similarity. Okay, so I thought, well, if we're going to tokenize these things, this is a way of exporting the code in a format that we can give out to other people. So step one is to take all of the lines of code and all of the files in your tree, tokenize them, and produce a serialized token stream which represents every file in that tree. Okay, so every token is one byte. Tokens with values have their token followed up by some sort of value which indicates what that value originally was. Now, originally I was actually putting the numbers in. So if I saw the number 3, I put the number 3 in my string. And then I realized that it was giving away too much of my original code. That people could actually see, effectively recreate a lot of the source code, because they could see what number was here, what letter was here, what string constant was here. So what I'm now doing is taking values, hashing them down to 16 bits, and putting the hash values into the string. So a piece of C code that looks like this becomes the for token, the parentheses token, the fact that there's an identifier, and the value of the identifier's hash is that, followed up by the equal sign, followed up by a number whose 16-bit hash value is that. Along the way, I've also got file names, and every time I get to an end of line, I embed end of line tokens, not actually because I need them, but because later on I can go back to the original file and work out where did these lines of code actually come from. So far, so good? All right.
Yep. A quick one.
Yep.
What about hash collisions? Have you thought about that?
In fact, I actually intentionally made the hash of 16 bits because if someone says, oh, well, look, if I give out my source code, then somebody else will go, aha, I can do a dictionary attack. I can take the letter A and hash it and find out that 6FE2 is the answer. So there's a likelihood that the original variable name was the letter A. And I said, well, okay, but it's only a 16-bit hash. So there's going to be an awful lot of collisions down to that 16-bit hash. So the ability to reverse backwards to get the original name is pretty impossible because there could be thousands of different variable names that match that hash.
Okay, so this is a case where collisions are useful.
Yes, this is a case where collisions actually are useful. I didn't think about 32, but the space would have been too big.
You don't really have to invert that hash.
No. What I'm going to do later is I'm going to compare this string versus another string, and if I see two fours, two parentheses, two IDs, and two of these, then I'm going to treat that as a possible piece of actual code.
So 8 bits would not be enough, it would be too small.
Yeah, 8 bits would be too small. 16 bits is about the right for collisions, but also for still similarities. Mm. Okay, so the advantage of having this representation, which I call the C token format, CTF, is that I release the essential logic, so you can see all of the ifs and fors and whiles and assignments, arrays, function calls, all of that sort of thing. But I don't release the names of the variables, I don't release the values of the constants. However, if I do get two files that use the same variable names, use the same constants, use the same identifiers, they will get the same hash values, and I will see a run of tokens. I'm not dealing with white space, so white space has been thrown away. Even though I'm embedding end of lines, I ignore them when I'm doing my processing. So I can also deal with white space additions to the code. Because I'm not dealing with lines anymore, I can take a whole bunch of code from here, which has then been cut and pasted down to here, with the lines rearranged, so some tokens have moved on to the next line, and I can still match that rearrangement to the original arrangement. And because I'm hashing, there is a strong enough argument that the proprietary code base could be released without revealing too much of the original code. It would be an awful lot of effort for someone to reverse engineer back to anything like the original code, especially as numbers get hashed as well. So your for loop, which goes from 0 up to 32, you would have a struggle to work out what was the ending number if you were given just the serialized token. Okay, just as a concrete example, here is what a token stream looks like when I reverse it back to printable form. I've also put the indenting in because you guys read in it indenting, but of course in reality it doesn't have any indenting. So I use the line numbers just to let me know where these tokens come from, but that's about all. And here are the actual tokens. So here's an identifier, hash number 891. Here's an identifier, hash 32607. Here's a numeric literal, number 49. What you can see is that the logic of the code is obvious. Well, you can see the logic of the code. So we've got ID 100 is some sort of index into an array. Later on, we increment ID 100 so that we must obviously at some later point in time move up to another part of the array. And we've also got a limit on how far ID 100 moves up to.
Or given that you're hashing, so for example in lines 390 and 391,
yep,
it is theoretically possible, if I interpret you correctly, in your system, that those two references to ID 891 in those two lines to originate from given grid.
No, it is possible.
It is possible.
Statistically unlikely.
But unlikely.
Very unlikely. But still not impossible.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, which also goes back to, and we're going to get false positives.
Yeah.
You know, so there's a tension there. How many false positives am I happy to live with?
Do you have some sort of tuning parameters for each false positive? You can...
Not yet.
Mm-hmm.
I'll talk about it. Yes and no. Yes and no. So the original approach from a few years ago was to take one CTF file for every token in that file, walk the other file to see if there's a match. So we would start with the while, compare it against all the other tokens. Let's say we didn't find anything. Take the parentheses. Aha, we found a parentheses. Well, is this identifier and that identifier hashed the same? No, they're not, so we give up. Move on to the X, walk down looking for the X. Eventually we hit the point where we see an if, followed by an if, that one doesn't match, but eventually we come across a run of code which is the same. If, parentheses, identifier with a particular hash, less than, number with a hash, close parentheses, etc., etc., etc. I can work out how long a piece of code is that's similar between the two strings. Okay, now that's great, and my program from 3 years ago works and actually produces real results. The only problem is its speed, and the speed is depending upon the size of both of the inputs, because you're basically doing an n by n comparison of tokens versus other tokens. So in the worst case, if this is 1,000 and this is 2,000, then we're talking a very large number of comparisons, 2 million comparisons. That's if there was absolutely no runs at all that are the same. I did have some algorithms to help me speed things up, but even though they sped things up, it didn't change the fact that this thing wasn't going to scale. And of course, you could also only compare one file to another file. So if you had a library of existing trees, you would have to do an iterative comparison, this tree against that tree, this tree against that tree, this tree against that tree, to find all possible relationships between all of these things. Okay, so let's take a diversion, because this leads on to where I'm going with the current version. How much is a significant piece of code of copying? Obviously, there are a lot of idioms in any language, and C is no exception. So if we take a simple set of things that you would commonly do, walk a list or go from one place to another in a for loop, then that evaluates to being around about 13 tokens long. Work out the maximum value. Let's do a running maximum. That's about 10 tokens. A piece of Unix. Let's get the details about a file into a buffer. And if there was some sort of error, then we know that that file probably doesn't exist or we don't have permissions to read it. Okay, so 14 tokens. So I'm going to postulate an axiom. I think I probably have to do a little bit more work to prove that it's true. But let's say an axiom. Runs of less than 16 tokens are not significant. Okay, so the closest one is this. This is going to appear everywhere throughout pieces of Unix code because it's a common way of looking to whether a file exists and whether I can get to it. This is common everywhere. You would have seen this millions of times. And obviously, to do maximums, this code is going to keep reappearing. So if someone said, oh, look, this for loop is the same as this for loop, most programmers would go, doesn't count. It's too small. So I'm going to postulate an axiom. Less than 16 tokens doesn't count.
Sorry, I keep interrupting you.
No, that's fine. Please, question.
What if somebody's tried a well-known algorithm like Newton's method?
Yep.
Which is 5 or 6 lines of code. Have you tried looking at something like, you know, really common algorithms that you could have something a bit longer than 16?
I should do that. The idea is, and there's... In the States... In the States, to prove copyright violations, they have a three-step process which is called abstraction, filtration, and comparison. Abstraction says, at what level of copyright are we talking about? Are we talking about, in this case, we're talking about lines of code or elements in the program. The next step is to get rid of stuff which wouldn't count as copying. So that includes publicly known algorithms, that includes if you're interfacing with hardware that is the same hardware, there's no other way of talking to that hardware.
And it includes files.
Yep. If you've got existing standards like POSIX or you know some sort of Win32, the constants that are used there and their names are documented in standards, so therefore you have to exclude them from the process. So I guess I'm doing this, but it would have to go back through the filtration. Mm-hmm. So this is just an automated approach to find potential copying.
Give you a short list.
Because if you're given 100,000 lines of code to compare to another 100,000 lines of code and you have to do it by hand, you're going to be in for a long haul. Okay, so given that I think 16 token minimum counts as some sort of copying, can we use that fact to make our search a little bit easier? So I had this great idea about 3-4 weeks ago. What I'm going to do is use the 16 tokens in a row as a key. I'm going to use that key to look up a database to find every file, every source code tree that where that 16 tokens appears. Okay, so I can build this huge database and every key in this database is going to be a 16 byte long set of tokens. So let's take a group of 16 tokens and I'm going to call it a tuple. Okay, so it's effectively a long vector or a tuple. I'm going to use that tuple as a primary key in a database. And what's in this database, as a result of every lookup, is a list of all files in all code trees which have that 16 tokens in a row. Okay, now unfortunately what that means is if you've got a CTF file of n tokens, it's going to produce n minus 15 keys. So if I have 100,000 tokens in a row, I'm going to produce around about 100,000 tuples. And every tuple has to be inserted into the database. So the database is going to get big. Now I'm prepared to trade off size for speed. It's always a good trade-off. The disk space is relatively cheap these days. So I'd be prepared to trade off that in order to make my program faster. However, key collisions should be rare. If I just go back to the previous couple of slides, these 13 tokens in a row are going to be fairly common. But as the size of the tuple gets bigger and bigger and bigger, the possibility of, let's say if I had 40 tokens in a row, it's going to be pretty rare that any other file in the world is going to have those 40 tokens in a row, unless it's copied. So the idea is, hopefully the number of collisions should be rare. However, if there is a collision between these keys, in other words, this key is being used by more than one input file, then that indicates a potential case of copying. It doesn't indicate a full case of copying, it only indicates a potential case. Now, in particular, what I'm doing in terms of my 16 token tuple is I'm only putting in the tokens and I'm not putting the values in. So if I write this piece of code for a is equal to 0, a is less than 100, a plus plus, if a plus b equals something, effectively what I'm doing is I'm saying that's now an identifier, that's now a number, that's now an identifier, and I'm throwing, at the moment I'm throwing the values away. So there will be collisions. So key collisions should be rare, but in fact they'll probably be a little bit more frequent than I want. So a key collision indicates a potential possibility. I then have to evaluate that in much more detail in order to prove whether it is actual code copying. Let's just have a look at a key example. Here is the 16-byte long run of the tuples with, of tokens. Here is the actual C equivalent for each of those tokens. And here's the result that comes out of a database. So this tuple appears in two files. In the actual stream of tokens, it appears at this offset in one file, and it appears at this offset in the other CTF file. In fact, embedded in that CTF file are details about the file name, so I can actually also find which file it came from in both source code trees. And I'm also going to store in the database the starting and ending line numbers, so they can also go and look in more detail to find out whether it is actual copy. So far, so good? All right. Let me just give you a feel as to how big the database gets. I took four unrelated code trees. That's not exactly true. There was two trees that had some relationship, but not very much, only a few hundred lines of code and similar. Around about 100,000 lines of code all up. The overall database size was 41 megabytes. Okay.
Baby.
What's that?
It's a baby.
It does get bigger and bigger and bigger. The number of 16-byte tuples in the database is 350,000. Let's have a look at how many collisions and how many multiples we get. 82% of the tuples have one result. So only one file in all of those four trees have that tuple. So 82% are unique. 11% of the tuples occur in two places within all of those four trees. 3% occur three times. 1.6% occur four times. And obviously the number gets smaller and smaller and smaller. So when we get down to, does this tuple appear six times in all of those four trees? The answer is only 0.5% of the tuples in the database are sixes. Okay, so we're really interested in, those ones mean that there's no code copying of that tuple. Everything else indicates some possibility of some sort of code copying. In fact, if we take a look out of these 350,000 tuples in the database, only 6,000 of them are actually collisions between different input files. Now, in fact, there's always going to be a lot of collisions within a CTF file. So this for loop appears in one part of my tree, and because it's my tree, I probably have copied and pasted that in another place and I've reused it again. Now, that's not copying because it's my own tree. You know, I'm not worried about copying with my own tree. Yeah, that's right, self-plagiarism. I'm mainly interested in the 1.7% of copying that occurs between the different trees that are in the database. Now, unfortunately, although the database is reasonably well behaved, there are some malicious entries. Because I'm not using values from my identifiers, then this one pops up. num, num, 16 tokens that represent num, comma. There are 2,745 uses of that in all of these four trees.
In what context does that occur? I'm not all that familiar with C.
Big table, lookup table, yeah. So something like int a or x equals 3, 7, 9, 10, 11. Some sort of lookup table. Could be for doing crypto, that sort of stuff.
It's usually initialization of something.
The other way around, comma, num, comma, num, comma, num. Remember these are tokens, so the comma might come first. Again, that appears a lot of times. Then arrays of strings. 1,809 times, 1,764 times. Now, because I'm not embedding the identifier values, this causes a lot of collisions here. I'll come back and talk about how I can mitigate against that in a few slides. So, now that I've got this database, I had this great idea. All right, so now that I've got a database full of tuples, what I can do is, for every token in my input file, from that point down, generate a 16-byte tuple, look up the database, find the list of files that use that tuple, and now I've got my potential code copy. So for every result that comes out, because it has that tuple and it's not in our file, I then go off to do that CTF comparison that I did way back in version 1.2. So I now go back and do that, but the only time I do it is when I already know that there's a run of 16 tokens in a row that have to be the same. Okay, I started writing this code and I was... Yeah.
Sorry, Warren, that solves your problem with this list of numbers as well, because you've got the source.
Yep. And when I do an actual comparison, I'm actually doing not only the tokens, but any values that are associated with them. So that quickly gets rid of, if this is 3, 7, 9, 10, 11, and another file is 2, 2, 2, 2, 2, then as soon as I get to the first actual value, I can discard the run. And then halfway through writing the program, I hit my head and realized I was an absolute fool. What the hell am I doing this algorithm for? I don't need to walk from the beginning of my tree down to the other end. Every time I do that, 82% of the results I'm going to get are unique. So in other words, I'm wasting my time walking down an entire tree when I'm mostly getting nothing there to report. In fact, I already told you that there were 6,059 entries in the database that were collisions between different trees. The database already has all of the collisions in it. I don't need to walk my tree to find the collisions because the collisions are already represented in the database. So instead of walking my tree, all I've got to do is walk the database. All I've got to do is go through the database and find those tuples with multiple entries. They are the only possible entries that could possibly be code similarity. Once I pull out each and every one of the tuple collisions, then I perform my real code comparison to see whether there is actual similarities between the code. Fortunately, in fact, it wasn't until I was writing these slides for the presentation that I realized that, and that was last week, or no, about 10 days ago. So now my algorithm is much more simplified. For every key in the database, get the result. If it's a unique one, throw it away, forget about it. If it's multiple results but within the same input file, again, I can ignore it. So when I get to here, it has to be a multi-file collision. So for all result combinations in that tuple, do a cross-compare between all of those results. So let's say, if I go back to this one just a couple of slides ago, here's a result with exactly two. So all I have to do is compare top to bottom, and hey presto, I've done my comparison. If I've got three, then it's a combination. Okay, I've got the top one, bent the bottom two, the middle one against the bottom, and then I'm done. This is a lot easier, fortunately, and it's also a lot faster. And now the time it takes to do it is not dependent upon your input file. The time to do it is dependent upon how many entries are in the database and how many of them are actually collision entries. Okay, so version 1.2 was order n by m, where n and m are the number of tokens in each of the two input files. To take an example, this tree is about 20,000 lines, this tree is about 50,000 lines. Back using 1.2 on my computer at the moment takes 73 seconds. Compare 2.2 is not order n, I won't say it's order n. It's also probably not order n log n, but it's somewhere getting close to order n log n. And I have to quantify this to actually get the value, but it's certainly not order n squared. To do the same comparison, 2 seconds. Okay, so I'm comparing about 60,000 lines, roughly your opcode, to look for all possible similarities. Time to compare all of those 100,000 lines of code, around about 5.6 seconds. And that means that's not just this versus this, this is all combinations of all four trees all compared at the same time. The thing that is slowing me down at the moment is the database construction is slow, but I have a suspicion it's because of the database I'm using. And I'm investigating alternative ways of representing the database.
What are you currently using?
I'm either using GNU DBM, which is a flat file with a variable or fixed size key, and I'm using Berkeley DB, which does the same sort of thing. So I'm not using a real database, because effectively all I've got is a single table with a key and a result.
You're sort of just using an in-RAM database?
The database gets big quickly. So now we've been up to
2 gig of RAM?
Oh, it gets bigger than 2 gig.
Okay.
Yeah. So
I give it.
I also, if you think about it, you want it to be a library, so that you want to be able to store the database so that if later on someone says blah, 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 you can import their CTF file, you've got your database in existence.
So that's kind of a one-off operation in that sense, isn't it?
It is.
Do a whole lot of things.
Yeah, once the database exists, then you can do whatever you want with it. I'm going to be spending, and there's also another bottleneck which I've been talking with Phil and Patty to try and come up with an issue, and I think I've got some ideas to solve that as well.
So basically you're looking at every release of the code, you rebuild it, you put a new version of the database.
Yep. And in fact, there's nothing stopping you from having multiple databases. The problem is if you take an existing version and then insert a later version, you're going to get an awful lot of collisions because of the similarities. So remember that the main point of this is to try and look for stuff where supposedly there is no relationship. So you would probably not want to put every version in, but as necessary you would put versions in to test them out. Okay, now I'm going to move on to, I've talked about comparing tokens, I've talked about comparing identifiers, and of course if I'm comparing one hash against another hash and they're different, then of course my comparison fails. So I want to talk about this, which I did back in version 1, but it's still really cute, so I thought I'd throw it back in because it's fun. Here's an algorithm, here's another algorithm. Are they the same or are they different? In fact, evaluate and tell me in English what you think this function actually does. It should be pretty obvious, given the name of the function. We're given three integers as input. What do we return? We return the largest integer. Okay, so x is bigger than both of them, we return x. If we get to here, x isn't the biggest one. Maybe y is. So y must have been bigger or equal to x. So if it's also bigger than z, then we can return y. And if we get to here, z must be at least equal to, if not bigger than the other two, so we can return z. Now we've got a second function. It's called big triple. And it takes as input variables b, a, and c. Now algorithmically it's exactly the same, but if I compare identifier hash versus identifier hash, I'm going to not see this as code similarity. So we need a way of being able to see whether there is any evidence of the same code with munged variable names and nunged function names. The way to do this is by looking at if we can build a table of relationships between identifiers. So looking through this code, X always appears at the same place where the B variable appears. Y always appears at the same place where the A variable appears, and Z likewise for C. So there's an isomorphism between the two variables. There's a one-to-one relationship. Fortunately, dealing with this is actually easier than I thought it was going to be. What we have to do is, when we first see a variable, we record its existence, and of course I'm using the names here, they would be the hash values in my actual code. I record the fact that it's the first variable I've seen. When I go through my other file, of course, if it is the same code, that variable will appear in the same place. So all I've got to do is record that B is the first variable, and now there's a relationship between the two. When I get down to the next variable, I record its existence, and hopefully I'll have a variable over there, maybe with a different name, hash value, and I get to record it as a second. And I continue through building up a relationship table until eventually a token mismatches, which is the end of the run, or a variable mismatches. So maybe later on, a new variable called Q appears on the left-hand side, which appears to be the same place where there's a B. Well, I can fail at that point because Q might be related to B, but I already have a previous relationship of B pointing back to X. And so therefore I know that this is the end of the similarity. So if I go back to here, if that was the letter X and that was the letter C, then I'd be able to go all the way up to the left-hand parentheses. I detect the breakdown in the relationship, and from there down to the parentheses, from there down to the parentheses would only be the code that's similar. So I'm building up, how far can I go? Starting at these 16 tokens, how far can I push this to find the entire length of this run of similarity?
I can see the value of that if you've got a formal list of parameters and heading things, but what about local? They can be in any order.
They can be in any order as well. Okay, so there are things that if someone really is malicious, they will always be able to make something look different. I was thinking for something like this. Let's write one piece of code. For x equals 0, x is less than 100, x plus plus. Well, I can write that for x is equal to 2 minus 2, x is less than or equal to 98 plus 3, x plus equals 1. If you really want to be malicious, you can always do anything with numbers, change them into expressions, which immediately breaks down. So as soon as I hit that minus sign, I would be comparing it against the semicolon and my comparison value.
We're doing essentially source level comparison with a little bit of parsing.
Just a little bit of parsing, yeah.
So for example, an optimizing compiler would condense that 98 plus 3 into 100.
Yes, yes.
101.
One of the reasons why I also chose to do it at the source level and not after a compilation stage is in languages like C, you can choose to exclude or include whole runs of code. So you also have to predict what particular flags were turned on during the compilation process in order to do a comparison. Yeah, so.
Is your final product going to be open source?
Yep.
Then potential pirates should be able to see your algorithm.
Yes. 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 Okay, so isomorphism is really nice. Here's an example of an isomorphism result between two old versions of Unix. Well, once this is actual Unix, and this is BSD code, which was supposedly written independently, or rewritten independently. But as you can see, the variable names have changed. In fact, there's three different identifiers. We've got thread wake up versus wake up, the coercion to a different type, int versus C out of T, and the name of the list. One's called SW list and one's called B3 list. But effectively, it may not be actual evidence of coughing, but it strongly indicates that there's been some coughing. Okay. So if you're a lawyer who says, I'm looking for anything that gives me an indication whether there's some code coughing, then significantly large numbers of these things that keep popping up would be indicative of some sort of coughing.
So you sort of trying your methods to code produced by decompilers?
No, I should do that. So you could go...
Because you've only got access to the executable.
Yep.
And I'm assuming there's some decompilers on Unix.
Yep.
And then apply your stuff, yep. At least a small example for that.
I should do that as well. Yeah. How are we going for time? Running out, but I'm nearly at the end. I only do isomorphism with identifiers. I'm not going to do it against string literals, I'm not going to do it against character literals, I'm not going to do it against numeric literals. Because if someone says the number 5 in one place, then the algorithm is probably going to be different if it says 17 in the same place in a different file. Okay, so I'm looking at variable changes, variable name changes, and not anything else. I'm certainly not trying to deal with this issue. That's something that's past what my program can do. The idea of isomorphism sounds complicated. It actually turned out to be extremely elegant. And I'm talking 4 lines of extra code, so I was really surprised. However, once you start building up relationship tables, it then starts to slow you down, because everything is a relationship until you get the identifier which breaks the relationship. So instead of 2 seconds to do the comparison, it's now 15 seconds. And instead of having 36 actual results, you end up having 7,000 results, most of which are bogus. Because 16 runs where there just happens to be the value A here and the value X here. And in fact, if you look at the real code, there is no relationship. So there are a lot of things that are not exact. So, how do we deal with this? I'm reporting lots of false negatives by doing code isomorphism. How do I do it? One way of doing it is to set a limit on how many relationships can be in the table. And this helps. I mean, there's a case in 2 versions of Unix where they have a whole bunch of function prototypes. Function, 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 function. And in another tree, same thing. Function, 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 function. Obviously, these two are not related. They're just lists of names. However, isomorphism will say, well, this one appears and this one appears, and they only appear ever once. This one appears and this one appears, and they only ever appear once. So far, they must be isomorphic. This one appears. So by the time we get to the end of the list, and there's about 80 of them in each, I have an apparent piece of code copy, which of course isn't true. But if I limit the number of relationships to, say, 3 or 4, then by the time I get to here, I stop. Because there's no way, I've effectively limited how long I can allow my relationships to grow. And that helps get rid of a lot of bogus isomorphism results. Going back to the fact that the database has collisions, and a lot of the collisions were malicious, if I go back to num 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 num, comma num comma num, lots and lots and lots of collisions, because I'm not actually using the variables, but the actual number values. One way to solve that problem is to take my 16 tokens in a run, find all of the actual values that come after those tokens. So every time I see a num token, I've got a 16-bit value. Hash all of those values together and stick them on the end of the key, thus making an 18-byte key, not a 16-byte key. So I now have 2 extra things on the end of my key which represent the values of all of the numbers and all of the strings and all of the character constants within that run. I now use an 18-byte key to look up the database and not a 16-byte key. Now, the only possible way there could be a collision is if all of the 16 tokens are the same and the exclusive OR of all of the values associated with those tokens are also the same. Now, this significantly reduces the number of collisions when there are just tokens the same, but numbers are different. Now remember that I'm taking the numeric hashes, which are only 16-bit, I'm XORing them all together to produce effectively another hash. So again, there is still a strong statistically likelihood of there being false collisions. But it's a hell of a lot better than having no way of disassociating them. So this reduces the size of the collisions, which also means by the time I get to do the actual comparisons, there are less collisions to deal with, so less potentials to check and eliminate, and so that the performance goes up as well. And I think I'll skip that slide. Oh no, just quickly. How do I prove that this works? Back in the early 1990s, someone did a hand comparison between two trees and found between those two source code trees, I said 15,000 and 40,000. Oh, sorry, 13,000 and 230,000 lines in that, so I didn't realize. He could only find 56 lines, and it must have taken him 3 weeks or so to do it. I find all of them in a matter of 2 seconds, except for 7 single lines. Single lines or double lines which fall below the 16 token threshold. Okay. In fact, and of course, because I'm using isomorphism, I find runs of code that were not found by the original person that did the comparison. Okay, so he never saw that because the variable names are different. So it does seem to work. There are, in fact, several legal battles, either past or ongoing, where there are things being asserted which I can actually check for. So at least a good approach to be able to validate this is to actually have rulings and people have done other comparisons and use them as examples to test against. Okay, so last slide. I think lexical analysis is a big win. It's certainly a lot better than line-by-line comparison. There is also other work dealing with parse trees. So we actually parse it into a tree, a standard syntax tree, and then evaluate, do tree comparisons. Now that's a lot of work, but if there are similarities, you find them very quickly.
So one, what's your tree if it's not a parse tree?
It's a linear tree. Whereas if I was doing something like 5 plus 7 times 6,
yep.
I'd have 5 plus and then 7 times 6. And that would be an expression.
Kind of.
So you've got operator precedence.
That's a generalized expression tree.
Yep. So you're doing more semantic analysis than just straight syntax analysis. Isomorphic is a really, really big win. It helps you find things that you would otherwise not find, but of course it costs you in performance and also in the number of false positives. The idea of using token tuples was serendipitous. I thought it was just going to speed me up a little bit, but because I basically have all of the collisions in the database already, it's sped this thing up much more than I would have been able to predict. It's changed the order of complexity. I still can't quantify exactly what it is, but going from order n squared, it's gone down to at least order n, or maybe a bit better than order n. And even better, it means you don't have to do a comparison between every tree and every other tree in a combinational process. You can do it within the database itself. Okay, so it's a work in progress. I know there are still bottlenecks which are slowing me down. I'm still working on ways of getting around some of the bottlenecks to improve it and make it faster, but I'm pretty happy with what I've got so far. So I'll just keep plugging away and trying to beat the next set of hurdles and eventually get to the point where I can analyze it once I'm happy with its performance. Okay, question time.
So this would be a frequent company that is going into the Unix community saying that they copy their code, so this would be where they could create, put the stuff in a database without releasing their code,
yep.
And be able to run comparison,
yep.
Against it.
My idea is that if I go back to my CDF files, is that you take a tree and create a CDF file and just give it out. And anyone can look at it. And they, all they can see is the basic algorithmic elements, but they wouldn't be able to reproduce the source code. So I just quickly go back to my computer system. let's take a look at one of my CDF files. Let's do 32B. Oh, no, I might have to look at that page by page. So here's the sort of stuff that comes out. Okay, now there's a function with some variables and some while loops and some function calls. I think it would be pretty hard to reverse engineer that back to a product that would actually work. Mm-hmm. Now this is actually proprietary, or was proprietary code, it's now actually in the public domain, but when you look at that and go, yes, okay, I've got to create real code back out of that, you are having a bit of trouble. So I think there is definitely leakage of what is in your code, but I think it's probably vague enough that most proprietary people would be happy. Well, I know there'd be some who wouldn't, but the idea is to make it reasonably publicly available.
If somebody had kind of a snippet of code, the real code, plus this, it might be a bit more useful.
Yes. If there's already been leakages of other sections that you could then cross-relate back, then, I remember back in the Unix days when you would make a change to the system and put a patch out. And I always thought if I sat for 3 years and collected all the patches, it should be possible to glue them all together and rebuild the entire system. Okay.
Is there much literature on this platform?
Yeah, there is about a dozen papers. Some this approach, some go for the tree approach, some are reverse, some are in Java, they're compiling down to bytecode and then looking at the bytecode comparisons. There's a whole bunch of different approaches. I think each one has strengths and each one has weaknesses. I think I like my approach because if I show this to a jury, most of them would be able to say, yes, we can probably appreciate that that's the same. But if I take two Java bytecode sequences and then try to get the jury to believe that they're the same, or even if they're algorithmically the same, even though a for loop's been restructured, then I'd probably have a much harder time doing so. So I think my tool is applicable to the point where it has to go up to average human beings to be able to spot.
I should be talking to you. I'm involved in a case at the moment with Lakeslip, which is comparing Delphi and Vue.
Ah.
So I think we should get together.
All right.
I haven't even seen it yet. I've just been asked if I'm prepared to do it.
Oh, well, I'll talk to you about my consultancy fees later. You can bring me on as a partner. We can.
Your talk is extremely interesting. Thank you very much.
Yep. Any other questions? Any other questions?
The key, the land in the requirement, I think,
is
top key. Have you tried the 20 or larger or smaller? So why are you using 16?
I've seen code snippets that isolated don't indicate anything, but when combined with a whole bunch of other snippets, show that there is definitely a relationship between them. So if I set a minimum of bigger than that, say 40, then I'm definitely going to miss some things. Now what I can do, but let's quickly do this, going back to my thing, if I do, here's my 32B versus NET2 comparison. Okay, that's how long it takes. And here's the results. 18 tokens in a row, here's the source code from one tree, here's the source code from another tree. What I can do is I can say, well, let's limit my runs to 30 or more tokens. Okay, so now there's only two matches that are 30 or more. And in fact, what I can now do is actually show you the results if I just... and the minus X flag actually goes back to the original source code and extracts it. So now you can see that the top two on either side of the minus sign line, that is the same as that. And this... Now, I'm ignoring comments as well, so these two are the same. Okay, but if I turn on minus I, which is for isomorphic, then not only does it take a bit longer, but we start seeing things that are a little bit different. So here there's a constant called asleep. Down here, it's called TS asleep. Okay, so things like that. I-lock versus I-locks, and yet the code is pretty much exactly the same. Okay. But then at the same time, if I go a bit further, I'm not sure if I go down to size 20, we will start seeing a lot more false positives. Let's see if I can find some false positives. Now, first false positive. Okay. Those list of function prototypes versus those list of function prototypes. You'd have a strong case to argue that they're exactly the same. And I'm sure I can find some other runs of constants that really, there's more. Obviously, the list of functions at the top and the list of functions at the bottom are not exactly the same, so you'd have a strong argument that they're not co-copying. Okay. Any other questions? If not, thank you very much for coming along.